Welcome. You're listening to the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast, live from the Fly Fishing Show in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Fly Fishing Journeys is proud to be broadcasting live from the event and having great conversations with many of the finest fly fishing and fly tying experts in the world. You can find these podcasts posted to our website, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Facebook. To stay up to date with these and other Fly Fishing Journeys adventures, please be sure to follow and subscribe. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
In this episode of the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast, Tom Baltz shares about the legends of the Pennsylvania limestone streams and spring creeks. The Latorte, the Big Spring, the Yellow Breeches, and the like have a special lore and heritage in American fly fishing history. Names like Charlie Fox and Vince Marinaro are synonymous with the area. We talked about the difference between a limestone and a spring creek and even touched on the English chalk streams. Tom is an Orvis-endorsed guide and an accomplished fly tyer. His paranymph was magical on a backcountry pond in Labrador for me this summer. It was the end of an incredible day catching brook trout on dries. We followed the hatch that started with the green drakes, then the brown drakes, and finally the gray drakes. My guide didn't have anything as small as the gray drakes, and the fishing slowed down a bit as the fish weren't taking anything else. I showed him my box and he went directly to Tom's paranymph and he said, "Try this." We tied it on and proceeded to land a beautiful 6-pound colored up brook trout. I later told Tom that if he was there, I would have kissed him. He wasn't quite sure how to take that. Anyway, if you see Tom at a show, be sure to grab some of his masterful paranymphs. Speaking of the shows, you can find out all the details about the show season at flyfishingshow.com. And finally, here's a word from our favorite vice, the Norvice.
From the original prototype designed in the late 70s to our brand new legacy stainless steel vice released in 2018, Norvice has been committed to one thing: efficiency. Tie better flies faster. A long-standing slogan with the company truly encompasses what the Norvice fly tying system does. What it means is to tie a fly in less time and more consistently due to the ease and benefits engineered into this outstanding system. For more information, please visit www.nor-vice.com. Norvice, the most innovative fly tying system on the market.
All right, thank you, Josh. And we are excited to have Tom Baltz here. Tom lives just outside of Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. He's with Angling Adventures, a very acclaimed fly tyer. He's Orvis endorsed guide since 2001. He's been fly tying for over 55 years, so Tom, we just aged you. I'm sorry about that. He's also on the board of the Pennsylvania Fly Fishing Museum, as well as on the board for the Cumberland Valley Trout Unlimited. So Tom, thanks for being on our show.
My pleasure.
So we're here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Before we get into all the rivers we want to talk about with Pennsylvania, the Latorte, the Big Creek, we're going to talk about a bunch of these rivers here. I'm sorry, Big Springs. What are some of your roles here at the show?
Well, I always have a tires table, and then I usually do one or more featured fly tire events where, I present on some aspect of fly tying to enrich people's knowledge of the game, of the art of tying flies. So,
sure. And how long have you been coming to the fly fishing shows as a tire?
25 years or more.
Yeah.
Quite a while.
What do you like about the fishing shows, the fly fishing shows?
You know, there's like two different main groups of people. First of all, there's the other exhibitors and tires, many of whom I would have not met, not being able to come to the show. Some of them become pretty good friends. And then, of course, there's the people who come in to see what we're doing. And a lot of them have been clients or just people I've known. And you know, you always meet some new people. It's all about the people, whether they're behind the table or in front of the table. So that's a lot of fun. I mean, you know, it's telling fishing stories. And
tell me about your role as featured fly tire. I know you've been tying this Parachute Adams, or that you're very acclaimed for your parachute. So talk about your parachute.
My main signature fly, I call it a paranymph, because the idea is that it's a floating nymph. It's a platform for, some people would call it an emerger. I don't like that term because it really doesn't tell you very much. When I say a paranymph, it's a parachute-style fly. It's not quite a dry fly because part of it's actually underwater. That's the body part, the part that the trout cares about. and they have high visibility wings. I change the colors depending on lighting conditions. So the standard one has a bright orange wing, which shows up the best under the most conditions. But if you have a dark background or you're fishing in the shade or low light conditions, I make a yellow wing. Particularly out west, when you're on the Missouri River, there's a lot of flat water, very similar to the Latour or something like that, only a lot bigger. The water had a lot of glare on it, and the bright colored wings hid in the glare. You couldn't see the fly at all. So I had one with a black wing on it, which I didn't invent. I didn't invent any of that stuff. Other, you know, George Harvey was probably the first one to tie the brightly colored wings, and I don't know who came up with the black wing, but you know, using it's the proof of the pudding, so to speak. You know, knowing about it's one thing, but if you don't use it, it doesn't help you.
Sure.
So I tie that same exact fly with those different wing colors. That part's for the angler, and the other part's for the trout, and that part doesn't change. Super effective fly because it's very generic.
Paranymph.
Parachute-style fly, but the idea is that it's a floating nymph. It's a platform for a hatching fly, a little nymph drifting along at the surface. It looks like a mayfly that's getting ready to, but can't, isn't quite getting it done yet. So it's very looks very vulnerable to the fish, as opposed to a hatched fly, which is on the surface and might fly away at any second.
Yep.
If you have ever watched mayflies drifting along on currents and some fish feeding on them, you'll every now and then you'll see one that just looks like he's dead meat, so to speak. I mean, he's going to go right over this trout down here, and he's getting eaten. And interestingly, probably not by chance, I don't think, right before he gets to that trout, he takes off, flies away. And if he's a little trout, the trout might jump after him. The big trout don't do that. They're not going to waste their energy jumping out of the water after one bug. But, you know, the trout, every place he moves in the water, he has to displace water. And there's no doubt in my mind that those bugs that are floating along on the surface can feel that movement of the water when the trout moves to come after them. And if they can, they're going to try and get away.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them get away and some of them don't, so the trout can make a living too. But I've seen it when big trout are rising in the right situation, you can see the water move.
Yep.
So, but, you know, when you're a mayfly, if it's even a 6-inch trout or something, you're still going to know that water's moving. They've been doing this for a long time.
Where were you born, Tom?
I'm originally from Albuquerque, New Mexico. In the mid-60s, we moved east to Rockville, Maryland, and that's where I went to high school and college at the University of Maryland, and I moved to Pennsylvania in 76.
You moved to PA in 76?
Yep. I was already fishing in Pennsylvania, the area that I fishing and hunting pheasants. Started about 1968, I guess, was the first time I came to that area.
How old were you when you moved from New Mexico to Maryland?
Oh, without calculating, I'm going to say like 13 years old.
Okay.
Or something.
So what was like... what was like life in New Mexico as a young boy?
It was great. I mean, we had a little neighborhood that was kind of surrounded by agricultural areas. There was a lot of farm fields around us, not a lot of other residential development other than our neighborhood. So we would walk back across the fields toward the Rio Grande, and along the Rio Grande, the river, there are a lot of, we just always called them drain ditches, but they used those to turn water out of the ditches and through a network of smaller and smaller and smaller ditches to irrigate the fields, the farms. You know, New Mexico being, generally speaking, semi-arid country, if you don't irrigate, you're not going to grow anything.
Right.
So those streams, though, those ditches, and that's all they were irrigation ditches, carriers off to the side of the main Rio Grande, a lot of them had trout in them. They stocked them. Very few probably had any natural reproduction, but some of them, one in particular, was very, very similar in character and size both to the Latour. It was flat, it was full of weeds, just like a spring creek. It really was pretty. When I was little, too little to really take advantage of it, but my dad fished them, not so much with flies, but there was beaver ponds on them, and, you know, beavers just follow the Rio Grande down from maybe even in Colorado. Who knows where they came from, but they were pretty interesting places to fish in a lot of respects. The one I fished the most, the closest one, was actually a fairly large waterway, too wide to cast across with a spin casting rod, which is what we were fishing with then. And barely, there was one spot we could wade across, barely. And it was a pretty stiff curve. My mother never was real comfortable with us fishing in there. About half a dozen people a year drown in that ditch.
Wow.
So it was pretty hairy. But
what was your first recollection of fly fishing?
The first trout I ever caught on flies, the very first trout I caught on fly, was in the Hamis River, which is a creek. Pennsylvania, we would call it a creek, but out there, the Hamis River, 40, 50 feet wide or so. An area near what they call Battleship Rock. I really didn't know what was going on, but I think I saw a fish rise, and I had a couple flies. They were just flies. I don't even know. I tied on a black gnat, sort of a wet fly thing, and of course, after a couple casts, it got wet and it sank, and I don't know, if I had a bite, I just had a feeling to lift, and there was a fish on there. So even at that point, I was getting pretty good at catching them on bait.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a problem of knowing where the fish were and things like that. And it was time to ramp the game up. And again, I was probably like 12 years old or something, maybe.
Yep.
And I started picking up a few fish on flies. I caught some in some other little streams up in that same general area. Not in those big ditches where we fish near home, but I would fly fish in them now. But they were limited in their bug life. Midges, but they weren't little midges. They were, yep, you know, an inch long.
So then you ended up in Maryland, and you went to the University of Maryland. You were a terrapin?
Yep.
What did you go to school for?
For a while.
For a little bit.
Yeah, let's leave it at that.
Okay.
A couple of years. But you know, I always had an itch to be in the retail business, and obviously something with sporting goods. So I started working with initially Montgomery Ward's, and in their fish, you know, in sporting goods in general, I kind of got like the fishing department dumped on me right off the bat because nobody else knew anything about it and they didn't want to fool with it. So it was kind of cool. And then I kept downsizing. I mean, I instead of getting into bigger operations, I always got in from Montgomery Ward smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
I went from there to what was at that time the largest sporting goods, private sporting goods chain in the world, Herman's, out of Carteret, New Jersey. And I started working with them in one of their smaller satellite stores. They had a big store down in Washington, D.C., which was the place to go in D.C. at that time if you were a sportsman.
Yep.
You know, you had Abercrombie and Fitch in New York. We had Atlas Sporting Goods in Washington, and then Herman's bought them out. So I started one of their satellite stores, and then it got transferred down to a new store they were opening in Northern Virginia, in Vienna, Virginia. It was, at that time, was the second largest sporting goods store in the world. We had over 70,000 square feet of selling space. It was huge. And it was like a whole collection of pro shops under one roof. So it was really awesome. I mean, we're in a basically a chain store, but we had Thomas & Thomas bamboo rods. We had lots of flies and fly tying equipment and all that. Everything. We didn't carry boats, but we had all the hottest, latest bass fishing rods, gear, lures. Lose speed sticks were a big deal at one point when they first came out. We had a lot of good stuff. It was a great place. But I came from there to what was then known as an Orvis shop, which is the equivalent today of a full-line dealer. And I worked for Barry Serviente at Angler's Art in Washington, D.C. for a couple years. And I got a call from people at the Yellow Breeches Fly Shop, who I knew from these other stores. They were interested in having me move to Pennsylvania and work in the fly shop up there. Well, that wasn't too difficult a decision. I was up there in like 2 days permanently. And then Barry sold the business, and he lives near Carlisle as well now. So we're both around the Carlisle area.
You guys still get together?
Not too often, but Barry used to be partners in the fly fishing show with the present owners, Chuck Faremski.
Right, I knew the
and
name.
Ben Faremski and the family. And so Barry was partners with Chuck at one point, and Barry wanted to retire, so Chuck bought out Barry's interest in the show. I mean, that's my understanding of it. But yeah, I still see Barry once in a while. He's around, but we don't see each other regularly.
Sure. No. Well, let's jump into that whole South Central PA area, because I mean, there are some very famous water and very famous rivers. I mean, we're talking about the Latourte, the Big Spring, the Limestone Spring Creeks, the Yellow Breeches.
Yes, it's a really neat area. How I first found out about it was certainly as a result of these streams, but Joe Brooks had an article in, I believe, Outdoor Life. I could be wrong. Could have been one of the others, but I think it was Outdoor Life. It was called A Weekend in Carlisle. Charlie Fox, I think, knew Lefty Cray. I'm not sure exactly what the initial connection was. Somehow or another, the word got to Joe Brooks that he should come up and fish these streams.
Yeah.
You know, they were already pretty well known because Vince Marinaro's signature book called A Modern Dry Fly Code came out in 1950.
Wow.
He wrote about the fishing on the Latourte particularly, but also on Big Spring and the Yellow Breeches. At any rate, Joe Brooks wrote this article called A Weekend in Carlisle. I saw that. This isn't that far away. I've got to go up there. Well, I was still like maybe a junior in high school or something like that, but I talked to my father, who thought there was no trout fishing in the East. He was wasn't a fly fisherman, but he liked the small streams in north central New Mexico, beaver ponds and little small trout streams at the Guaynas River, where I caught my first trout, was a favorite of his. It was the core area. at any rate, he didn't think there was any trout fishing in the East. So he did bring me and my youngest brother up to Carlisle, and we, I don't know, stayed at a KOA campground or something like that. And we caught a couple fish on dry flies in the Latorte, you know, and it was just like walked along, and there's the fish rising, just like it said in Joe Brooks's articles. I like, every time I could get back to that area, I came back there. And I think the first time we fished there was about 1968. So I started fishing it as much as I could from then on. And then when I had an opportunity to move to that area in the mid-70s, it didn't take, you know, too long to make that decision. So great place. Charlie Fox and Vince and their books that they wrote really created the aura and the legend of the limestone streams. These are special streams. They're not like other trout streams, especially the Latorte, Big Spring. They're just big springs. They're giant springs. They're relatively low gradient streams. The water stays cold. They're not very long, 5 or 6 miles long, the whole stream. You can walk right up and say, boom, stream starts here. It comes right out of the ground. Big Spring comes right out of the base of a cliff. Starts right here. There's no, some water runs into it when it rains, but
no headwaters.
This is it right here.
That's amazing.
So it's pretty unique. I mean, you could take what we commonly referred to today as a freestone stream, and you can follow that up until it trickles, and you still can't say it starts right here.
Right.
You know, you might hit a wet spot at some point, but there's not a real distinct beginning for those kinds of streams for the most part, where these spring creeks, I mean, boom, there it is. That's the upper end of the stream, and you can follow it down to where it drops into the Conedogwinet Creek, which generally drains the southern side of the county, the valley, the Cumberland Valley. So all the Latorte, Big Spring, Yellow Breeches goes directly into the Susquehanna, but the other ones all drain into the Conedogwinet Creek, which is kind of a big limestone stream, but more, it's a Class C trout stream, as Pennsylvania rates them, which means it has some trout. They move around and in and out of these spring creeks where the water's cold. This time of year, obviously, the water's cold in the whole stream, so they can go anywhere they want to, but it's a rich stream. It's mostly a bass and muskie fishery.
Let's talk about Latorte now. Okay. Can you differentiate between spring creek and a limestone, or can they be both? How does that work?
The way I consider them is spring creeks are limestone streams, but not all limestone streams are spring creeks. Might seem odd, but to me, a real spring creek is relatively low gradient. It's not really hard. There's in the entire length of Latorte, I can think of two riffly spots, and one's kind of riffly depending on the water level, and the other one drops right at the bottom. It drops over a fall, so it's riffly there, a little bit right in the very lower end. But other than that, it's a low gradient, flat surface, so it's a great dry fly stream.
Yep.
But you also sight fish for the trout with nymphs and things. Frank Sawyer, who was a river keeper in England on a chalk stream, invented the pheasant tail nymph and a unique way of tying it using wire rather than thread so that it had some weight to it. It's not real heavy, but it's still got some weight, and you can see a fish that's laying in a foot or maybe even up to a couple feet of water, and you can drop that little fly in ahead of him, and you just have to watch the fish and guess when he has it. Very interesting and rather difficult fishing. It takes some practice. A limestone stream has a generally similar water quality to a spring creek, but it has a different character. It has rocks in it, has riffles in it, gravel bottoms, not so much weed. The Latorte has like a 5 or 6 square mile watershed. The Yellow Breach is way over 300 square mile watershed. So much larger stream. It's 50 some miles long as opposed to 5 miles long.
So the Yellow Breaches is a
limestone
stream. Okay.
Yep.
Now, the differentiation between a limestone and a chalk stream now.
Water quality or water chemistry wise between, say, the Latorte, a spring creek, and a chalk stream, it's very similar in that they both flow out of these geologic formations that are heavy in calcium content. They're very high pH, they're very alkaline streams. The chalk stream in England, and actually in parts of France and so forth too, they flow out of these big formations of literally chalk. The White Cliffs of Dover are chalk. My understanding of them anyway is that there's not so much of a distinct spring there as there is this water just oozes around through this chalk, which is very, very permeable, and it oozes out. The Romans dug some of the chalk streams. They're drain ditches, basically. The Romans they wanted to drain the meadows so they could farm them. You know, this goes back a long ways.
What would the water look like? Would it be,
it's very clear, and not a lot of color to it. Again, very clear. The chalk streams in England, a lot of weeds in them. They're very carefully manicured because mostly it's private water, and they have somebody that's paid to, you know, to mow the weeds. In other words, to keep the stream right so that the guys who pay them have good place to fish and,
yep,
you know, Our streams get a little bit hairier because nobody's paid. Our TU chapter does the best they can to cut some weeds and do some things like that to keep it fishable, but they don't get the TLC that a chalk stream in England would get because, again, ours are maybe on private property, but mostly open to public access. The La Torte is virtually all private property, opened by the courtesy of the landowners. The Big Spring, at least the part that most of the fly fishermen would be familiar with, that actually the Fish Commission owns that. The Yellow Breeches, of course, being a much longer stream, is a little bit of a mix. The state owns a little bit of it. Fish Commission has one of their largest hatchery fish facilities in the state is up at Huntsdale.
Let's talk about the history of the La Torte. Now, I know you mentioned that there was this article by Joe Brooks, and you know, said you got to come up and fish the stream. Is that how it kind of got the famousness of like La Torte?
Well, going way back, there was one of the earliest settlers around Carlisle was, a James La Torte, who had a little trading post and maybe did a little bit of farming and, you know, so it's all subsistence stuff back in the probably early 1700s, traded with the Indians and so forth in the upper reaches of the La Torte. You had a real steady, high-quality water source, so, you know, that's where people tended to settle back in those days. This is before the French and Indian War, and, of course, Carlisle, during the French and Indian War in the 1750s, Carlisle was the frontier. Everything from there west was wild country. There were various little forts which were very much less grand than one might imagine. A couple dozen people in most of them, Anglos anyway, and then of course the Indians were raiding them and et cetera, et cetera. The French and Indian War was an ugly time. General Braddock left from Carlisle to head west to his fate at Battle of Bushy Run. But you know, over the years and during that time frame, actually, some of those British officers, the British Army was stationed there. I mean, this was still the colonies. British officers have always been the gentry. They fished and shot birds at home. They fished when they got here, too, and some of the earliest writing about fishing in this country, really, was done by some of these British officers. Notably, I can't remember the particular general's name offhand, but he wrote about fishing the tiny little flies in Big Spring. And so Big Spring really was the birthplace of what we call midge fishing in this country today, where they're tiny little flies. The local guys were making their own hooks out of needles. They were bending them and snelling them on horsehairs and things, and they were little wet flies, basically, because the tackle just wasn't, you know, back then wasn't what it is today. And they were fishing these little flies that were the equivalent of size 20s or even a little bit smaller.
Interesting.
Very tiny flies, and this is in the 1700s, where even from Carlisle out to around Newville was a major trip where, I mean, the general had his entourage and wagons and his supporting cast, and they went camping for days. You weren't just going to ride out and fish for the afternoon.
Right.
So the fishing there goes back a long way.
So they needed some subsistence.
They probably kept the trout and ate. A Big Spring back in those days was full of brook trout.
Yep.
And that's what its claim to fame was at one time. I think the native brook trout are gone. There's still wild brook trout in there, but highly questionable whether any of the native stock is still around. At any rate, you know, those streams, the fishing was... the fishing made the fishermen, and the fishermen wrote about the fishing, which is what makes the fishing famous in any place. Aside from the earliest writings, which are not known generally, especially today, you had guys like Charlie Fox and Vince Marinaro who wrote about it. And Vince Marinaro's book that came out in 1950 called A Modern Dry Fly Code was a more 1950 modern, but a more modern look at fishing, particularly with imitations, flies that suggested terrestrial insects. Vince never claimed that he originated terrestrial insect imitations or terrestrial fishing, as we call it today, but they modernized it with new fly patterns and new techniques, and their tackle was not, again, what it is today, but it was still way better than it had been in the late 1800s, you know, the late 19th century, when some of the first writing about those kinds of flies came out. But Vince Marinaro came out with some patterns for ants. His Jacet is a very famous fly, the little jungle cocknail on top, which was also not only a little beetle or a little leafhopper type of an imitation, but you could see that white spot on the jungle cocknail out there on the stream. So these were relatively small flies that float kind of flush in the surface. They were fairly hard to see, other than you could see that white spot to some extent. So sort of a high visibility thing too.
Yep.
And then Charlie Fox wasn't as much of a fly tire, but he was very much a technician as far as fishing. He was a very good caster and fisherman. And he liked fishing to these fish that would get up on the shallow weed beds and root around in there and knock bugs loose and then drop back and eat them. And that was always fun fishing. It was always sight fishing. So you weren't blind nymphing. And it was like a little pheasant tail nymph or Charlie fished a pattern that George Harvey used for little blue-wing olives. He called it the horse collar nymph. It was just kind of a thread body with a one turn of chenille around the upper end of it to make the thorax. Very simple pattern, but you know, it was good enough for the fish. It's all sight fishing. You'd spot a fish working, and then you have to time your cast to get the fly to him when he was ready to eat. And then Charlie, of course, wrote Rising Trout, and he wrote this wonderful World of Trout, which is still reasonably available. Rising Trout's a little harder to find, but about the fishing and the fishermen in that area. One of Charlie's good friends was a commercial fly tyer named Bob Mercafferty. He was one of the first guys that tied just a plain, simple fur ant. Rabbit fur dubbing or whatever kind of fur they used for the front hump and the back hump and a little hackle in the middle, and they tried fishing that dry. You know, fly dressings even weren't what they are today, so they had their struggles with it, and Charlie writes at some length about trying to develop imitations of Japanese beetles, which were supposed to be the end of mankind back in the day when they first hit the States. You know, oh my God, what are we going to do with all these beetles? They're eating everybody's roses and whatever else. But the trout were eating the beetles, so they had this coffee bean beetle. You know, they couldn't keep it on the hook. It didn't float worth a darn. So they had their trials and tribulations with some of that stuff. But that's what they worked on developing flies. In Vince Marinaro's second book called In the Ring of the Rise, I had met Vince by the time he was working on that book. One of the stories in that book is really about how to develop a fly pattern, and he uses a particular bug to as a vehicle to tell the story of how to develop a fly pattern. And too many people took it literally, which Vince always thought was pretty funny, and tried to come up with a housefly pattern. Vince never tied a housefly. Mm-hmm. He never tied a housefly pattern at all, but he made this story up about the old barnyard stretch on the Latorte, and there was not houseflies, but they looked like they're on the manure and whatever in the barnyard, which was right next to the stream, and he made this story up about developing a fly to catch these trout that hung out in the area down below the barnyard. But that never really happened. It was just a way to tell the story of how to develop a fly pattern for any bug.
Mm-hmm.
So he always thought that was pretty funny.
That is pretty funny.
Most people today still don't get it about that story. But anyway, those guys wrote those books, and at the time, I can't remember the name of the prize, but Cornell University apparently awards a prize annually to a work of nonfiction in American literature. And Vince's book, was the only fishing book that ever won that prize. Many people, students of fishing literature, consider that to be maybe the very best American fly fishing book, period.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's pretty awesome. It was pretty awesome to know those guys. Charlie Fox was just the nicest, gentlest soul you could possibly imagine. A very accomplished man. He did a lot of things. He was the editor of the Pennsylvania Fish Commission's magazine called Pennsylvania Angler. He wrote at least one book on the Battle of Gettysburg, in addition to his books that he wrote about fishing. He owned a stretch on the Latorte. They did all kinds of experiments there, trying to increase the hatches, trying to increase the fish that were surface feeders because they wanted to dry fly fish. One of the little mill races that are still evident along the Latorte, although if you didn't know what you were looking at, you'd probably wonder what that thing was. It's just a wet spot now, a lot of them. They actually, you know, all that was farm country, and every little farm just about had a little bit of a mill just to, you know, handle their own stuff and maybe their neighbors or something. But any place there was water, I mean, people lived there not only because they had something to drink, but that was power. So they had little mills, and they had these little mill races. And those guys, when they caught a fish, they did this experiment. When they caught these fish on dry flies, they took them and put them in this mill race, which they could live in there. It's just like part of the stream. But they blocked it off so they couldn't get away. And they kept them in there until they spawned, and then they let them loose. You know, they just pulled up whatever blockages they had, let the fish swim wherever they wanted to go. They had spawned in these mill races, and these were all fish that they had caught on dry flies. And their impression, very subjective as it was that for some several years afterwards, they had better dry fly fishing than they normally were used to. They got these fish, thought they were, you know, somehow genetically programmed to feed on the surface more than some of the other trout. So they did lots of different experiments like that. They tried transplanting bugs. They tried to bring the green drake hatch from Penn's Creek into the Latorte. They never got more than two or three bugs out of that. Just didn't work. You know, the green drake doesn't like living in the Latorte.
Yep.
So
bugs are going to be bugs.
Bugs are going to live where they want to live. And if they want to live there, they're already there.
You know? Exactly, yeah. Well, talk a little bit about the history of the fish that reside in the Latour. What was the Latour known for back in the day, and maybe how is that compared to what how it fishes now?
Way back in the day, all those streams were full of brook trout, you know, when the British were there.
Well, that's what I was reading in the book last night, is that the brook trout is the Pennsylvania's
state fish.
State fish.
Well, we have so many teeny little mountain streams that are that have brook trout in them. There's some of the streams that go into the Yellow Breaches that are they're just trickles, even now when we have more water than we're used to with all the rain over the last year or so. Just little tiny trickles, and a mature brook trout in there might be 4 inches long or less. You know, so when they're in these little tiny creeks, they just don't get very big. But in these spring creeks, they got bigger. Some people think there was 3 and 4 pounders in there because I think Ernie Schwiebert wrote about that and kind of made that up.
Not a fisherman telling a fish tale.
Ernie was kind of known to exaggerate. Anybody knew him?
No.
And anyway, you know, I know Charlie. I said, Charlie, one time we were talking at what they called the 19th hole, which, you know, back in the way back, Pennsylvania's trout season ended in the, at the end of June. So they legally weren't allowed to trout fish after that. They did lots of other things. They played golf and they went salmon fishing. And Charlie had a camp in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, somewhere up there anyway. It's along the Miramichi, whatever. They did lots of other things. And so they had this spot basically in Charlie's backyard that they called the 19th hole.
As
opposed to 18 holes of golf.
Right, and then have a beer.
It was the hangout where, you know, when they were done fishing, they would have a little, you know, hot dog cookout or, you know, a drink of beer or whatever. We just had some cinder blocks with boards across for benches and, you know, stuff like that. But we were sitting there chit-chatting and watching the fish one day. And, you know, I asked Charlie, I said, what's up with these 2-pound brook trout in Big Spring that I read about? He goes, He said, not that nobody ever caught a 2-pound brook trout in Big Spring, but he said, you know, basically like brook trout anywhere else, if you caught one that was an honest foot long, you got a really nice fish.
Yeah.
You know, back then they ate them. I mean, the limit was 25 a day or whatever, and those guys were, you know, children of the Depression era and so forth, much different times than most of us are used to today. And, you know, they like to go hunting and they like to go fishing, but they did it with a purpose, too. They were eating it. They're not quite living on it, but it was certainly a major supplement for them. So, you know, even I got it from a number of the old timers contrary to what some people think about these big brook trout that lived in Big Spring, particularly 10 or 12 inches was about normal.
Yep.
Just like any other brook trout. So, you know, all those streams originally were brook trout, and then brown trout started coming into this country, and they were here and they were there. And Charlie told me that the first brown trout that he ever knew of going into the Latour came from another little spring creek that occasionally dries up that's not too far from where the Latour is. Mount Rock Run, I believe it was. It's just a little tiny spring creek. It's probably running good now. You'd think, wow, why isn't there trout in here? But we hit a couple dry years, there won't be any water in it. They hit a dry year, and I think it might have been Norm Leitner, who was a friend of Charlie's. I never met this man, but I've heard his name. He was a notable fisherman in the Carlisle area, knocking on Charlie's door. Mount Rock's drying up. You know, the trout are flopping around. They went up there with buckets and fetched them out, and brought them down and put them in the Latour. So that was the story that Charlie Fox told me about the first brown trout in the Latour. And then eventually the brown trout basically took over.
What was the transition there between the brook trout and the brown trout?
Well, they put the brown trout in, and then there was some brown trout, and there was some brook trout. Actually, there was still some brook trout in there when I first started to fish there, although I saw some, but I never actually caught one.
Right.
So what their origin was, I can't say, whether somebody stocked them in there, got them someplace, or whether they were the original Latour brook trout, I can't say.
Right.
I did see some brook trout. Over the years, people put some rainbows in there, including some of the wild rainbows from Falling Spring, which is a little south down at Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Guys literally put them in a 5-gallon bucket and drove as fast as they could get away with up 81 and, you know, before the fish died. Because Falling Spring was noted for wild rainbows. The Shasta River strain, Shasta River in California. These rainbows were basically non-migratory as opposed to most rainbows have some steelhead blood in them. And they want to go downstream when they hit about 10, 11 inches or a foot long, maybe. They want to go to the ocean. These fish didn't do that, had been landlocked somehow or some way. They didn't migrate anyway, and they put them in Falling Spring, and Falling Spring is colder than the Latour is, as is Big Spring. And yeah, you'd catch them for a couple years. Maybe you'd catch a few little ones, so some of them did spawn, but they eventually didn't make it for whatever reason. The conditions in the Latour, the size of the gravel maybe wasn't what the rainbows like, and they're pretty adaptable. But whatever, something in there wasn't as suited to the rainbows as it is to the brown trout.
So what is it like today if you were to go fishing?
Today, it's brown trout. I'm looking forward to this season because we've had a couple of decent years with good water. And those streams, everybody thinks the level doesn't change so very much, but it changes more than people suspect. I mean, they do come out of the ground. They're not as susceptible to, like, say, the yellow breeches with a much larger watershed. If it rains hard, it's going to come up and get muddy. The Latorte and Big Spring, generally speaking, don't do that. So they're dependent upon the water that's in the ground and the aquifer. But we had a couple of really dry years a few years ago, and I was afraid the upper Latorte was literally going to dry up. It was so low. And that was really hard on the fish, the herons and the birds can get at them. But now we've had a couple really wet years, and we had a couple good spawns, and I'm hearing some good reports. And our TU chapter did some work on the very upper stretch on the right-hand branch, you know, literally dug some of the silt out and pulled a lot of weeds out of there and recreated some channels. So I'm optimistic that it's a wild trout fishery. It's going to, some years are going to be really good, some years so-so, and some years maybe not too good. Those real dry years, it wasn't very good. Now, a lot of people fish the lower part of the Latorte, which is a more modern phenomenon because, in fact, Charlie Fox writes about fishing the stretch of Latorte downstream from Carlisle because it flows right through Carlisle. So you have stormwater runoff, and back in the day there was factories, some of whom discharged their stuff right into the stream, basically. It got in there. The lower Latorte was polluted for a long time. There were very few to no trout down there. They relocated the water treatment plant. Carlisle's facility is now on the Conotoguinic Creek rather than on the lower Latorte. So several different factors combined to let the lower Latorte come back to a higher quality stream.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, trout started showing up. And then the Fish Commission did go in there with fingerling brown trout and stocked it a couple years. Just with little, like, 5-inch long type. At any rate, the last time they surveyed that, to my knowledge, they had 5 times the biomass required to meet Class A wild brown trout water. And some big fish, too. Although you're not just going to go down there and see 4 or 5 pound trout rising all over. They get a lot of fishing pressure. It's open water, so you got guys fishing bait. You know, any kind of bait that guys might fish. There's guys fly fishing down there. A couple streamer guys hit that. And one or two of them catch a lot of, you know, relatively speaking. They don't catch a lot of fish, but a lot of the fish they catch are big ones. Big could be anywhere. Well, one guy's trying to break 30 inches. I don't know if he's broken it yet, but he's got some pretty big fish out of it. So mostly the very lower end.
So it's all open water? The whole 5-6 miles is all?
Well, the stretch upstream from the park in Carlisle, Latorte Park, from there up to the headwaters, it's a couple miles roughly, is catch and release fly fishing only.
Okay.
As it flows through Carlisle, it's open to anything, and you can keep 5 fish a day is the limit in Pennsylvania. But it's not stocked, although they might throw a few in the park area when they have a fishing derby for kids or something. Generally speaking, no, it's not stocked trout water. And as it flows through Carlisle and downstream another couple miles before it empties into a larger stream, it's just open water. You can bait fish, et cetera, but it's all wild brown trout.
And the fishing's good throughout. I mean, you don't have to be up in the fly fishing only section.
No, some guys never fish up there. The fishing up there is quite different than the lower. The lower end's big water. Even the upper end, though, the stream's bigger than it looks. You're on whichever bank you choose, but you're not going to wade back and forth across it very much. Generally, the tradition was fishing from the bank, like in England, the chalk streams. You stalk along, you watch the water, you spot and stalk fish, and then fish to them. You don't wade up and down the stream.
Like a freestone.
Right. In the warmer months when the weed growth starts to reach peak, the weeds themselves take up a certain amount of volume, and they literally push the water out of the stream and into the meadows surrounding it, the water meadows. So it's going to be pretty marshy. I prefer to wear some kind of waders up in there. I used to wear hip boots, but the technology of waders today, you get a pair of breathable waders, I just roll them down to my waist.
Yep.
They're way better than a pair of rubber hip boots that, you know,
right.
They weren't all that much fun. So
what are the good months to try to get after it over there in Latorte?
Some guys fish those streams virtually year-round. February here this year, we've had kind of a pretty much winter set in. It was cold.
Yep.
And it's not so much fun for anyone to fish in that kind of weather. But other than that, the guys were fishing. They leave it alone during the spawning time in mid to late November. But then they get back after it and December, going into January, as long as it stays decent out weather-wise, and some of them are getting ready to get cranked up again. To me, my fishing there would be more geared toward when the flies are coming off.
Talk about the hatches, because I know you said in a limestone, or it's going to be different than it's going to be like in a freestone.
In the Latorte, in a spring creek like the Latorte, you don't have a great variety of bugs. So you have what we generically call little blue wing olives. There's probably a couple of different kinds, but they're 20s, 22s, pretty small bugs. Might even be a few that are as small as 24. So that leads me to think that there may be a couple kinds of them, but there's a couple possibilities there. At any rate, you'd want to have flies from size 20 to 24, these little blue wing olive imitations. So we have basically two kinds of mayflies there, generically, blue wing olives, and then the sulfurs that are size 14, 16. And the peak time for the sulfurs would be latter part of May going into June. And then there'll be a little lull when that early, the larger, what Vince Marinaro termed the blue wing sulfurs, they kind of taper off. A small lull, and then what Vince called pale sulfurs, the pale evening duns. They're a little smaller. They're like a 16 size. They'll come off and on all summer. You need to pick a day with fairly low humidity where it's going to cool off right at dusk. If you got a really hot, muggy day, it doesn't cool off at dusk, and if there's any bugs, they must be way after dark.
Yep.
You won't get a fishing hatch. So it's a little spotty, but you learn to pick out the kinds of days when you're likely to get that evening rise sort of fishing on the Latorte in the summer. In the earlier ones in May, well, bugs being bugs, they're relatively unpredictable. You can only kind of generally say, you know, let's go see what happens and maybe we'll get some flies. But I've had some good fishing in the past. Those streams aren't noted for big, heavy hatches, which is what led to the fishing and the development of these flies that imitated the bugs that fall into the stream, the terrestrials, beetles and ants and crickets and hoppers and you name it. So the lack of those hatches. Now, Big Spring is also a spring creek, but it's different than Latorte. It gets a few little blue wing olives and a very few sulfurs, but it's like loaded with midges.
Interesting.
So again, the first midge fishing that was written about in this country was on Big Spring back in the mid-1700s, roughly. So it's noted for all these little bitty flies back when most of the fishing was in the very upper end because of the pollution from the Fish Commission's hatchery there, which has been closed now for 18 or 19 years. The fishing was just in the very upper end from the head springs down a couple hundred yards, the area that's known as the ditch. It was really the remnants of an old mill pond. But there was tremendous big trout in there. I mean, lots of them, and just in that one stretch. Usually had company when you were fishing. You were going to be the only guy on the stream. I mean, I can remember hooking trout that would weigh 5 or 6 pounds on, like, size 26 flies and stuff.
Yeah.
They were eating them, too. I mean, they were rising and taking these little teeny tiny bugs. Landing a fish like that is another story, but you could get them hooked anyway. Every now and then somebody would land one, but...
So if I pull up and I park and I start walking the banks of the Latorte, you said you want to spot and stalk.
Yep.
What is my approach to try to get into some fish? What would you do if you started fishing?
Well, when Charlie Fox was still alive, he literally built benches. I mean, again, there was two center blocks and a board across them. But you'd sat on the bench like they do in Europe. These guys brought that chalk stream tradition from Europe over to the Latorte particularly. You sat and watched, and sometimes, I met some interesting people sitting on those benches. I met Buck Metz there before anybody outside of Buck Metz's family and a couple people around State College. Nobody knew Buck Metz and Metz necks and all the genetic necks that we use for dry fly tying today. So notably, that's where I met Buck Metz, was on one of those benches. But you'd sit there and wait till you saw a fish rise, or at least spotted a fish. If he wasn't rising, you might still want to fish for him. If he's going to feed on the weeds, you go fish for him with a nymph instead of a dry fly. But you'd sit along the stream until you spotted a fish doing whatever he was doing, and then you went and tried to catch him. Maybe guys even took turns. You know, it's your turn, my turn. I made 10 casts, you make 10 casts. You know, there's a lot of ways to share that, which is another thing that really made the fishing over there special.
Fun.
Most of the benches aren't there anymore. There's nobody to really maintain them.
Right.
And the whole stream wasn't lined with them, just mostly the area that Charlie owned and so forth. But still, if there's not a bench, you're still going to sort of sit or kneel or something. And you got to wait till you find a fish and then fish to them. Now, there were some guys that always just ran weighted nymphs down in the channels of trout will dart out from under the weeds and grab them. So, you know, to each his own. But the real limestone fishing, the real Latorte tradition was that spot and stalk type. Get a fish, he's eating on the weeds, he's rising, rig your tackle up and try and catch him.
That's interesting. You know, that'd be fun. Yeah, I love that headhunting. We tried that. Well, we actually did that out in the Bow River, and it was a slough channel off the cut. It was a cut channel off the side of the Bow, wasn't in the main river. But those fish were just kind of cruising around, and then you'd see them come up and down, and we would take turns.
Yeah.
From the bank.
Yep. Cool. That'd be very similar then to what I would call the Latorte tradition.
Yeah. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was special.
Well, good. Well, before we close, Tom, why don't you just tell us, like, what would you do? Like, you have that fish rising. What would you do to try to catch it? Would you try to match the hatch? Would you try to go for a blue wing? Would you do a nymph?
If there's some flies in the air, or, maybe you saw spinners flying upstream a little while ago. Now they've gone up in a riffle up above somewhere, and that's where the spinners fall. So you can tell by the rise form, and that's evening fishing. You're not going to be, if you're over there at 10 o'clock in the morning, that's not going to be a factor.
Yep.
If you've seen sulfurs coming off, the duns hatching, most likely it'll be probably at least a late afternoon, if not an evening, toward dusk affair. Little blue-wing olive is more of a daytime thing. But you're going to see there's some flies flying around. You see a fish rising. Well, that might be a fly. I try an imitation one of those. It'd be a fly to try. But if it's middle of the day, you don't see any really bugs, any real insect activity, especially if you get a little bit of wind. Then you might consider the terrestrial imitations, which is part of the foundation of the Latorte tradition and what Vince Marinaro wrote about in his Modern Dry Fly Code, his book. So what kind of bugs? Well, that's pretty sneaky stuff, really, because you got to go look in some of the bushes, maybe. But basically, it's ants and beetles.
Yep.
Ed Shank came up with this cricket pattern, which is a heck of a fly. It's a real good fly to use. Whether the fish think it's a cricket or not, I don't know, but they do like it. It's a good-looking bug. Hoppers I never did a lot with, but, back in the day, back in the 50s and the 40s, when Vince and Charlie were young guys and they were fishing a lot and everything, those kind of brushy and wooded areas along the Latorte that you see today were all farm fields. And you had a lot of grass and you had farm crops. And of course, back in those days, they didn't use all the chemicals that are used in farming today. So there was lots of bugs in there. And hoppers, of course, there was a lot more hoppers around then than there is now. You need a lot of hoppers to get a few of them in the stream. You might actually have a better shot at that today in the lower parts of the Latorte where there still are some big grassy areas adjacent to the stream. But in any case, what fly to use? The fish is rising. You don't see any mayflies around. Caddis aren't a big factor on the Latorte. I've seen some over there over the years, but not very many. So we're looking at some kind of a terrestrial, an ant, a little beetle, generically. But on the other hand, if you happen to be enterprising enough to know that particular bush right up there along the bank is infested with a certain kind of bug right now. Of course, some of those bugs, different beetles or whatever, are seasonal. They might be around for a couple weeks, and some of them are around for maybe a couple of months. But you kind of build that knowledge the same as you do about your aquatic insects. And if you pick the right beetle imitation to use below a certain bush that's full of beetles that size, you can really, really do some business. But otherwise, most guys are going to try an ant. If that doesn't work, they're going to try a beetle. They might try a bigger one or a smaller one. Japanese beetles start showing up around the end of June. They're not the big infestation that they were at one time that everybody was so worried about when Japanese beetles first got.
Yeah.
We have our own modern day insect scourges. Presently, they're trying to keep the lantern flies on this side of the Susquehanna and not let them get over where we are. A lot of that has to do with the fruit growers. But at any rate, some of these bugs are pretty nasty to a lot of different trees that we might have in our yards and things like that. But so there's different ways to pick that dry fly out for the Latorte.
When do you decide to go under?
Well, you don't see any fish rising, and you see the fish laying out on these shallow weed beds. I referred to that earlier, that was the fishing that Charlie Fox really liked. You'd see these fish, they'd come up and lay literally just inches of water on top of the weed beds, and then they would literally go in there and grab a mouthful of weeds, and you'd see them shaking their head, knocking bugs loose. They would drop back in the current, and they'd be grabbing whatever stuff they knocked loose. And, you had to time your cast so that your fly had time to sink to the fish's level. And it had to be at a time when he was dropping back and eating. If he had his head in the weeds, he wasn't going to take your fly.
Right.
So, there were some tricks to that. That was a lot of fun, that kind of fishing, too. You had to, it's sight fishing with a nymph, so you can't see the fly. You have to kind of guess where your fly is, and if you think the fish ate it, set the hook. So,
yeah.
As simple as that, and yet that's not so simple to actually do that. Some days you just didn't see fish out, and again, I just go home. I only live 10 minutes away.
Yeah.
Go somewhere else.
Let me ask you, Tom, where do you guide? I know you're a guide.
As far as guiding, I'll guide on the Latorte some, but the Yellow Breeches is the longest and the biggest trout stream in our area. It's user-friendly in that, it has stock trout, it has wild trout. the average person, even beginners, no experience whatsoever, could go there and have a chance to catch some fish.
Yep.
Not everyone does, but you know, usually you're at least in the game. Last year was tough with the weather and the water conditions were up and down, but it's got a lot of different water on it because it's a long stream. You fish the upper reaches. It's fairly small and intimate up there. Some stretches really don't even have a path along it. I can only take like one person at a time.
Yeah.
But as you go downstream further and further and further, it obviously gets larger and I can handle, you know, two or sometimes three people. But I like to take two people. Keeps me busy and gives each of them time to fish on their own. And the breaches also, being a larger stream and a little different than the pure spring creeks, has a little more diverse habitat, and you have different sized rocks and gravel, and different current speeds. You get different insects. You get some bugs going to take advantage of every niche there. When you have a lot more niches on a stream like the Yellow Breach, is a bigger stream, than you do on a stream like the Latourte, which looks pretty similar from one end to the other, other than it's got a little more water in the lower end. It's bigger. Other than that, pretty similar as far as the habitat, gravel in the bottom and muddy kind of banks and a very limited, there's lots of bugs, but they're limited in variety.
Well, Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast. Thank you for your time. I know you're away from your booth over there, and I do appreciate that. And I'm going to come by and pick up some of the paranymphs.
That's my signature fly. So, yeah, stop by and see what I have, and we can talk some more over there.
That'd be awesome. Well, good. It's been great to have you. Why don't you let our listeners know how to contact you or connect with you if they want more information on South Central Pennsylvania, your angling, or the museum there?
My phone number is area code 717-486-7438. My email address is baltzte@aol.com. Those are two main ways. You can also go on the Orvis website at orvis.com, bring it up, navigate to fishing, navigate to trips or travel, and they'll show you an outline of the United States with some circles and arrows, and you can click on Pennsylvania and bring up all the endorsed operations in Pennsylvania. You'll find my landing page there if you click on my name, which has some details on general weather trends over the course of the year, the streams we fish, hatches you might encounter if you come. Well, I think quite a bit of information considering I basically have one page on there. It's not quite a website, but sort of a mini website.
That's cool.
But you can click right on my name on that and send me an email too.
That's excellent. Literally. So basically it's the Orvis website into fishing, Orvis endorsed guides, and then Tom Balt, BALTZ.
Correct.
Tom, thank you so much for giving us all this great information on the history of the Latourte. Thanks for letting us know about South Central PA, and we'll be sure to stay in touch and follow what you're up to.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.